secretary with Mrs. Lord Stanton, and the person who will occupy that seat will be Ida Sussman. This is the second part of a two-part presentation. However, let me hasten to assure you that part two is independent in and of itself. If you saw part one, which was the film, Metropolitan Avenue, it will all fit together exquisitely. But if you didn't, that's nice too. Okay. The theme, which as you can see, which we'll be talking about today, will be working class, has to do with working class women and community, which was the theme that the film addressed in the morning presentation. And I will be giving a kind of theoretical I will be giving a kind of overview of the problem of women of women in communities, community-based organizations. And I will be talking about the strength, the particular strengths that women bring to communities and community organizing. In a sense, a great deal of our literature in the women's movement has been to point out the oppression of women. And we haven't looked so much at the strength of women. Also, over the years, we've seen that the women's movement has been attractive to certain people, but not to other people. And in a sense, when we talk about working class women, working class and poor women in communities, we are talking about a group which has not, by and large, been attracted by the women's movement. Even though the interesting thing is that when you talk to many of the women, they share many of the feminist perspectives, but in certain ways they are put off by certain aspects of the movement. So what we hope to do today is to look more closely at these women and their lives as this particular arena of community, which is their area of strength. The community is the social unit to which most people relate in their daily lives. That is true in urban, suburban, and rural areas. People have a sense of belonging to their community or neighborhood, which they do not have in relationship to larger political and social units. The community is where we live. Lynn Loughlin, in an essay published in Another Voice, an early collection of essays which attempted to create, quote, a feminist perspective on social life and social science, unquote, reviewed and critiqued that body of literature known collectively as community studies. She noted that while women were acknowledged to be present in communities by researchers doing these studies, their presence was seen as both passive and peripheral. They were like the servants portrayed in British mystery novels, she said, who appeared on cue to serve the tea and perhaps to discover the body, but who had no real character and engaged in no important action, whose existence in no way advanced the story. They were merely there. She blames this sexist myopia of the researchers on a number of factors, which include priorities of the funding organizations whose financing had made the studies possible, what she terms the obsessive search of sociologists for either community or its absence, social disorganization, and by the proclivity of male researchers to do their participants' observations, that is, hanging out in bars rather than beauty parlors. thus, she concludes, they When searching for community in bars and social clubs, in civic organizations and local politics, and on those famous and ubiquitous street corners in which so many of these studies take place. In these settings, she reported, they indeed found what they were looking for. They found community. But they did not find women as social actors. I would like to propose a quite opposite hypothesis concerning women's role in the nature and creation of community. I have up until this point not defined what is self-evidently my central concept, namely the concept of community itself. Community has been seen in the social science literature as pointing to both a specifically bounded geographic area and a set of meaning-giving concepts which people construct and share, and which provide a sense of identity and a sense of belonging. Both the sense of geographic boundedness, or turf, and the sense of belonging to a human community of shared meanings and values are more important to some individuals than to others. Social scientists have tried to understand these differences through the use of such categories as cosmopolitan and local, the people who would be more important to the scene as local, people who would be less important to the scene as cosmopolitan. Or more recently, the community of limited liability, that is, some people who voluntarily limit their ties to other communities. However, in those areas and among those groups where community continues to be important, and we need to a large degree in working class and poor neighborhoods, I maintain that community building is and always has been the work of women. My definition of community would include both the geographic sense of the term and the sense of the term which refers primarily to shared meanings and values. I believe that community is a process. It is the process by which we transform our geographic sense of living in a particular area into a sense that this fact is meaningful because of the human network which arises as a consequence of it, and through which we are able to share space, time, face-to-face communication, mutual aid, and common values. Once we move from a view of community as a concept to a view of community as a process, we are able to see that community exists because people continue to act in ways which both make it possible and create it on an ongoing basis. The community, as I define it, following categories which have been formulated by Alfred Schutz, a sociologist and philosopher of the social sciences, is a life world, a world of people's lived experience, a world created through the unique relationship of consociates, that is, people who share time and space in face-to-face interactions, which have continued over time. For most people, the community is subjectively understood as the world within my reach. That is the world which I define as being within the scope of my understanding and within the realm of my active intervention. If, as Lachlan contends, that male researchers have failed to see the women in the community, then I would like to take his contention a step further and suggest that by not seeing women except as there, they also fail to see community, especially community as process and the life world which is thus created. Because it is women whose work it is to carry on this continuing process. Further, I suggest that the researchers she describes fail to penetrate the ongoing dynamic of this community building process because, in fact, it has not yet been theorized within the social sciences or within historical scholarship. Much recent scholarship in history has been devoted to understanding the separation of the public and private spheres of existence. to recapitulate in very rough and broad terms, and hoping not to offend any historians who are present, it has been suggested that the Middle Ages were an age in which people lived more closely together, with fewer separations between the public world of social life, work, and business, which was not sharply distinguished from the world of the household and family. In this world, work was often done and business transacted at home. The trend in the modern world is to increasingly set the household aside as the private world of family, and to separate it from the busy public world of work, business, the marketplace, and public affairs. The family too changes from an economic entity and a unit of production to a set of emotional relationships and moral ties which functions economically only as a unit of consumption. Within this newly defined, and by newly defined we mean roughly coinciding with the period of industrialization, household and family unit, women and children are to be protected, but women are also diminished as human beings by their lack of participation in the real world of men and affairs, and by the growing devaluation of their unwaged work in the household. Women in this private world are neither workers nor citizens. However, as the weight of scholarship in both historical and contemporary in women's studies has shown us, women create other spheres between the public and the private, spheres of love and friendship, spheres of neighborliness and community, even spheres of political activity beyond their household. This is a submerged world of community in which the role of women is critically important. Carol Staff, in All Our Kin, her groundbreaking work on female kin-based networks in a poor black urban community, shows how participants in these networks create a world of reciprocity, exchange, and mutual aid, which makes life possible on the lowest end of the economic scale. I discussed it in Norman Street, shows the continuity between women's informal neighborhood networks and community organizing and political action in a poor and working class area. These two works taken together help us to make the submerged world visible. Women in traditional neighborhoods create the public sphere of neighborhood life. They are intensely local in their focus. They not only reside in the neighborhood, they shop there, they socialize there, they engage in recreational activities there, but they have jobs, they often work there as well. The people who are important in their lives are also mainly local people. They spend almost all of their time in the neighborhood. As they make their daily rounds of shopping, visiting, escorting children, their interactions create the fabric of community life. They are particularly alert to happenings on their own block. Is someone ill and in need of attention? Is an elderly person shut in and in need of having errands done or in need of household help? Has a family suffered a misfortune, job loss, serious illness, or death? Women respond to these situations with both material and moral support. Women routinely keep an eye on all the children on their block and exchange informal child noise as a matter of course. Women trade goods and services on an informal basis, which enhances the economic well-being of families with meager resources. We may see a group of women engaged in a casual conversation on a corner or in a shop and assume that the content of that conversation is only idle gossip. But these women are doing the work of building and maintaining the network which constitutes the basis of the life of the community. Further, they are circulating useful information, some not useful. What apartment will soon be vacant? What jobs are available? What schools are good and which are poor? They are formulating public opinion on subjects of importance to the community. On a somewhat more formal level, women supply the labor and the motivation which runs the organizations which sustain local life. These include PTAs, scout groups, community centers, block associations, tenant associations, all kinds of religious and church-related groups. It is women to see to and remember the celebrations which symbolically mark the cohesiveness of community life. Often, they engage in these activities around, through, under male opposition and the opposition of the local power structure. For example, one woman responded told me how she and her neighbors started a block association with the help of a local organizer. There was already a local civic organization, but it was male-dominated. Women could belong to the women offices. The respondent grinned as she told me. They didn't mind that we were forming a block association. They thought that was just about one step above a coffee club. However, this coffee club began to sponsor a variety of neighborhood projects which attracted then available federal money from the Office of Neighborhood Development, no longer available. Needless to say, the men hastened to join the coffee club for a share of influence, power, and access to jobs. It's interesting to note the differences in the quality of participation in community lives and community organizations between men and women. A national study of community-based organizations, which I did for the Office of Neighborhood Development in 1979, showed a definite difference in patterns of participation between men and women. Women are often the people who respond on an immediate level to problems in the community as they arise, and who organize small but deeply rooted groups to deal with immediate problems by protesting withdrawal of services, pointing out unmet needs, or getting needed information to the community. Women's approach tends to be holistic. They look at the needs of the community as a whole, and they look at people as total human beings rather than as administrative categories. One of the most fascinating findings of this study was that while women tend to start these organizations, this was a nationwide sample, by the way, 30 community organizations. Just to talk a little about the methodology, we asked women to answer an extensive questionnaire on their role in their organization. And then we asked a person, male or female, who was the head of the organization to answer similar questions so that we had this comparative perspective. Was that as these organizations tended, and not all of them did, but the ones who did, to get funding from outside sources, women who had started the organization in a direct response to problems tended to be replaced by men, both by neighborhood men and by outside professional men coming in. And that over time, funded organizations, tended to have less female participation in general, and perhaps more importantly, fewer women playing leadership roles, fewer women representing the organization to the public, and less input from women on policy issues. When we asked some of the heads of the organization how they took account of women's needs in the neighborhood in formulating policy, they simply told us that of course they took account of women's needs because they had women on their staff. That was a self-evident truth. And when we spoke to those women on their staff and we said, what input do you have into policy? The response was that they did the jobs that they did, which often were relegated to the lowest level. So the more funded, the more tied to formal organizations, the more tied to government, the more tied to foundation funding, the more women got shut out. Now, when we asked the women what they had to offer in terms of their particular expertise, they told us about their expertise, that they were experts on their own neighborhoods. And of course, everything we know about how women operate in the world of the neighborhood tends to confirm it. Women are experts on their own neighborhood. They know what the needs are. They know what kinds of services are required to meet those needs. They know, furthermore, the networks of communication that could make those services effective. Because anyone that's done community organizing knows that you can plot an organization down in the middle of the neighborhood, and it will simply be there, unless it feeds into what people are already doing, the networks that already exist, it won't be utilized. It's like it's not there. Okay, so what happens is, the more bureaucratic, the more funded these organizations become, they crush and contradict the goals of the little organizations that women start. And they spend more money to be less effective than women doing the kinds of informal community building that we talked about. Now, I'd like to focus on one more issue, and then I think I will end. We're going to hear more about concrete kinds of organizing from Laura and Ina. And that is the relationship of the concept of community to the women's movement as a whole. I would like to hypothesize that one of the latent goals of the women's movement has been, in fact, to create community. That even though we talk about ERA and other issues, it's lucky that we have them, because those are the issues that unite us and help to develop a sense of community. That in a sense, the working class and poor women whose community work we are reporting on have something of enormous value to teach the rest of us in terms of how to create community. I think if we look at consciousness raising, for example, we can look at consciousness raising in terms of its stated goals, right? That women learn to respect their own reality, that they become empowered as individuals, that they learn what they have in common with other women, etc., etc. But underlying that, consciousness raising was a way, and a very powerful way, of creating community. In other elements of the women's movement, we have had glimpses of the possibility of community. In our attempt to create organizations which were not hierarchical, where people could work together, those were attempts to create a sense of community. And I think that what I see as the next step for the women's movement, is to get away from what Hester Eisenstein has called the false universalism of the early women's movement, that the assumption that all women's experience is the same, and to look very concretely at the experience of women in communities, at their strengths, at the work they've done, at the obstacles that have come in the way of their work, and at what they have to teach us about creating community. Laura is going to tell us about a very specific example which took place, for those of you who saw the film, in the community where the film was made.
I'm going to focus on the Neighborhood Women's College Program, which was located in the Williamsburg Cedar Point community that we saw, those of you who are lucky enough, in Christine's film today. And I'm going to look at it as an educational model which used liberal arts education to build on women's culture and to create a community where women could learn to speak confidently in their own voices and get in touch with us. Their own intellectual capacity, personal capacity, and so on, to see themselves as experts in living in the world. The Women's College Program that I'm going to talk about was located in that particular neighborhood, but some of the principles that informed the program have been transferred to other areas. San Diego, California, people in Philadelphia use the same principles. So it does apply to a larger context. The college program, I would describe, was located in a community, about the community. It was anchored by the community in terms of the content, the process, and the structure of the program. The program began in 1974 with a few women who got together and said, as Terry described, women in neighborhoods getting together to create structures that serve their needs. A group of women got together and began to realize that this very community that represented to them their way of life, their identity, was in danger. The community was divided by with a typical working class ethnic neighborhood, divided by the disastrous consequences of urban renewal that has fallen apart. The women assumed, as you can see from the film again, that it was their responsibility to keep it together. And this is a theme that came up in all of the organizing efforts that I've been involved with working class women, the creative efforts, the sociological and scholarly findings corroborate that women see the family as an extension of the neighborhood, as an extension of their responsibility to the family. So they will organize to get a traffic light on the corner or a better school because their kids need it. And for those same reasons, they work to keep their neighborhoods together. The women assumed it was their responsibility to keep the neighborhood together, but also were aware that their familial neighborly ways of relating to the world were no longer adequate in the faces of the increasingly complex social forces and changes they were facing. Now, again, these were not only the threats to the neighborhood, both from within and without, economic threats and so on, but also the notion of their very identity as, quote, traditional women in a world where the roles of women were changing. These women were threatened practically on every front, literally where they lived. These women were joined by feminist educators. Now, this is where the notion of community building and a need for community kind of came together on the part of both the neighborhood women who were interested in developing their skills and acquiring an education that could speak to them as human beings, and the needs of a group of professional women, women who had considerable experience with educational institutions, with traditional education, and were feminists from working class backgrounds who wanted to kind of reconcile those different streams within themselves, who were, in effect, looking for a community. Most of the professionals who came into the program in 1974, that seems so long ago now, were, as I said, from working class backgrounds. We had a shared vision, three of us are in this room, Shelley, right? And a daughter who suffered through some of those visionary moments. We had a shared vision of a community of learners, something that we had not experienced ourselves as learners in traditional liberal arts programs, nor as academic scholars, nor as teachers in the system. We thought of a non-hierarchical community of leaders where in which feminist principles that were important to us, what we had learned through consciousness raising, through validating each other's experiences and view of the world, we envisioned as a method through which people could learn how to learn, and for some of us, it was an old-fashioned idea about a community of scholars and learners. These would all be women, and they would respect each other, share decision-making, it would be non-competitive, non-hierarchical. A lot of it sounds like the 60s, right? because many of us came from that perspective. But on top of the 60s, we also came from a more specific perspective, and that was that we, because of our working class background, no one wanted to be cheated. Our students, we felt, deserved and required, and this community was to be characterized by the very best. It was to be rigorously, intellectually sound, no hippy-dippy stuff. We're out of this paper. Now, we also came out of a perspective of the feminist movement and feminists at the beginning. Those were, if you remember, those of us who are old enough, the beginnings of women's studies, where we talked about it, we read about it, we argued about curricula of identity, as I think Lawrence Howe called her first one. We were talking about the students who came into the program, our regular college program, would have been inappropriate, alienating, and probably utterly impossible. We worked primarily with returning women, these are women who already had their family responsibilities, many of whom had jobs, who were community activists, so they were wives or not wives, mothers, activists, neighborhood leaders, workers, and people for whom the neighborhood was the world. For us, the professionals, for the rest of us, it would have been our vision of this kind of community of women, and not a Barnard College, but a neighborhood-based program of working class women could function while still operating within their primary sphere of comfort and necessity. For us, that image was not possible within the academy. Now, in re-looking at some of the current research on women's development, especially the work of Carol Gilligan, I found a useful framework for examining this college program in its structure and content, because now the program has been in existence for 10 years and has been successfully operating with some more or less tempering of the original image. I think there is always only a first time for everything, and some changes have occurred necessarily on these different priorities are different, etc. But still, the principles on which we built the program are sound and apparently remain sound as the program endures. Gilligan documents the difficulty women express in finding or speaking publicly in their own voices, and shows how women define themselves in the context of human relationships and judge themselves in terms of their ability to care. Our experience in traditional colleges where we were the consumers of an educational program set up for us by others, largely along the male model, convinced us that the program that we were designing and building had to be structured so that students made the key decisions about the program. We therefore, through processes which would have seemed organizationally diffuse and open-ended to traditional educators, and if you've ever sat in a curriculum committee meeting or a budgetary decision or an appointments committee in a regular college, you know exactly what I'm talking about. We hammered out decisions that In other words, we let the students create a structure within which they were comfortable to function, in which they would actively develop curricula, refine and design administrative procedures. The college was to be in the community. It was important that it be a community entity, informed, designed, consumed, created by the students who, and run by them. We hammered out a philosophy of education, an actual liberal arts program, which, though we did not at the time have concrete research data to validate, it proved to be based on certain facts about women's development. One was that women's strength lay in their ability to empathize with and care about each other. What for some people, and looking at the studies of passages through life, etc., have been seen as a weakness in the part of women's development, turned out in the form that the college program took to have been a tremendous strength. In their community, in the community that we worked in, there existed networks of support and resources, informal women's networks, which formed structures upon which the college program could be built. The students were skilled at working together. They knew how to share decision-making, solve problems, and cooperate. They cared about each other's opinions enough to see through to the arduous process of making decisions together. They gave each other support and were concerned about each other's achievement. Now, I'm not trying to give you a pie in the sky vision, because obviously this was not always true. But as a principle for organizing the college program and as a norm for behavior, it provided a structure that said, here is how you are used to operating, here's how you can do it in creating an educational program that teases and meets your needs. The women's tendency to perceive their ability to make sustained relationships as a skill proved to be a significant factor in terms of keeping women in the college program. Now, the women did not see themselves as intellectually capable learners. These, by the way, were not students who were deficient in invasive skills. But they were students for whom the notion of college did not, because of their class, ethnic background, economic background, seem to be for them. In their words, they really thought of college, and it seems sort of remote to us now, as a dream, and found the activity of learning new concepts and material extremely threatening and anxiety producing. Intellectual accomplishment and success, instead of being a joyful experience, is often terrifying to our students. Such reactions are corroborated by the findings of Martina Horner, who documented women's fears of success. In our case, the support and the acceptance of the group helped students cope with and even begin to enjoy leadership, intellectual accomplishment, artistic accomplishment, and different types of unaccustomed success. Another aspect, part of this success anxiety that was particularly frightening for the students in the program came from the external context which Terry had so clearly defined. The women were used to being the workers, they were not used to being the leaders, they were not used to being seen as important, and it's difficult to become different from a group, become different from your former self in the context where your very identity is tied up with people liking you, and we all know about that. Most of the students were traditional women who had been brought up to find the primary identity in the familiar role of wife and mother. When they talked about going to college and gave reasons for wanting a college education, there were gradations of motivations. At one level, it was so that they would learn how to be better able to save their neighborhood. Next, it was to be better able to help their kids with their homework, to be better able to help the kids choose a college, to run their families better. Almost, it was only much later that they were sitting around the church basement writing haiku on a cold February night and liking it, they might have said, well, wow, this is something in this for me, too. But it was not an expressed motive. The new identity as a person, seeing themselves as a person capable of sustained rigorous intellectual activity, was threatening and led often to a kind of double bind situation for the women. I look at this from the point of view for a second of some of the work that Helen Merrill Lynn has done about shame and the search for identity. I find the distinction interesting that she draws between shame and guilt. Now, our women in that program were guilty all the time. They were guilty if they did their homework because they were taking away from their family. They were guilty if they didn't do their homework because they were letting their obligation down. The double bind, I see from the nods at the head, is not an unfamiliar one to women. Lynn talks about guilt as described as a transgression of some rule or law. Shame, on the other hand, she says, results from one's failure to live up to one's image of oneself. To feel guilty is to feel one has done something wrong. To be ashamed of oneself is to have one's identity profoundly shaken. To succeed intellectually, artistically, visually, to stand up and be leaders and be appreciated and that visible for our students meant that they had to reorder some of their priorities of their lives, often going against or at least altering standards derived from years of being judged as women in terms of their perfection as homemakers. Now, lo and behold, us educated women would be embarrassed to have some of our students in our houses, and even though we had meetings in each other's houses, it was often extremely embarrassing. And only somebody who's been through this knows what it's like. My consciousness raising met in my living room and didn't notice a lot of things that our students would not fail to notice. You would go to a meeting and get up to start the meeting, and somebody might come over and say, "Well, let's raise your hand, get a little stop talking, and let's leave." You know? So this perfectionism informed women's way of operating. The women needed support of the learning community that we created to offset the guilt at taking the time away from their families. Now there's another level of this guilt and shame. They also had to begin to see themselves as participating in a woman's program. This was not necessarily positively received by the men in the neighborhood. We were in this program, I should say, dependent on the resources of the neighborhood for classroom space, for funds, for not necessarily for funds. We meant to do that pretty well on our own, believe it or not. But it was important that the neighborhood support this activity. Often women's husbands were furious at them.
they would not let them come to college. You can't go to college. It sounds unbelievable, but it was true. The program was in another neighborhood where I was involved, some other women who are here, in starting a program in another section of Brooklyn, which had a very male, very macho political structure that still exists. It's Christine's old neighborhood, so I've got to be quiet. But it's very Italian Catholic neighborhood. We had to ask priests permission to hold classes in their basements. Now, in order to get funds, we had to demonstrate community support, etc. And they, literally some priests standing there in their colors and clerical garb and full of Christian community gloves, slam the doors in our faces and say, "Get out, you lesbians." I need to say no more. This is a context that for the women, they were used to doing relatively powerless things together, but to create an entity, a cultural, educational, to create a new institution for them, run by them, built by them, and sustained by them was a very threatening activity as seen from the outside world. Even more, I mean, so that these women would, you know, say that they might have written. We had women who went on to become published poets, who were incredibly creative and talented speakers, who were gifted leaders, and what they really got punished for were their shortcomings as homemakers, or if anything happened to their adolescent children, it was their fault. And of course, they tended to see these disasters, which any of us who have had or do have adolescent children know, go along with the territory. They saw the backsliding, the slip-ups, the failures on their children's part as their fault because they were doing this other thing. Our studies though did indicate that the children of the parents, the women who came into the program and were successful, by and large, had tremendously increased motivation toward their own educational development. So that it was not a rational thing, but it suggests the level of this internalized perfectionism. And the strength and conflict of that double bind, you know, you can't win for winning and you can't win for losing, that women experience. Now, because there was a community, though, women could look around and say, "Look, I know it's hard. I know you must feel awful. Sure, your daughter got a D in math. But, you know, my daughter did this. My son did this." They shared experiences, they pulled each other through and gave each other the courage to go into which was fairly uncharted territory for them. And they got validation for change and growth from each other, which they were not necessarily until it came to be respected. And by the way, based on the stuff that Terry did for HUD about how once it comes to be validated by the rest of the world, then it's okay. When the college program started getting at publicity, when the Ford Foundation said, "I'll give you money to do this," and the Rockefeller Foundation said, "I'll give you money to do this," and the City University put it in it as one of its feathers in its cap in a catalog, the program was co-sponsored by the neighborhood group and a unit at the City University, then people began to say, "Hey, isn't that terrific? Oh, you're in that program." It was a very different kind of validation that the women experienced previously. Now, women's differences, a difference, Gilligan tells us, is rooted not only in the social subordination, but also in the substance of their moral concern. Sensitivity to the needs of others and the assumption of responsibility to take care can lead women to attend to voices other than their own and to include in their judgments other points of view. Women's moral weakness and our so-called instability manifest in an apparent confusion and confusion of judgment is thus inseparable from women's moral strength. An overriding concern with relationships and responsibility. Now, one of the significant components and perhaps most successful, dramatic and most successful aspects of the college program was that we built on women's overriding concerns with their responsibilities as a vehicle for intellectual growth and development. We developed a curriculum which was based on the community. That was our stroke of, it was a highly integrated program in that sense. Neighborhood issues were used as the focus of the neighborhood. Activities were collective, were project-oriented, and were product-oriented. Activities of the college program came to be shared with the community, and that went from video productions, community health fairs, poetry reading, to other kinds of research projects that generated social policy recommendations, political activism, etc. Finally, the existence of the college program as a women's community in a community like the one that we organizing in provided a delegation for women's experience as learners and as leaders. Thank you. Now, Ida is going to tell you everything Carrie and I did.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was very expensive when we first got
it. It was wonderful for a while. Over 10. We had the film, and I know that you've heard a lot about Greenpoint Williamsburg, and I want to talk about organizing among women in a different area, and actually, I want to kind of show that it's not just all in Greenpoint Williamsburg in a way, because I think you might think this is an exceptional area. And obviously, in every different situation, you're going to have a different kind of organizing. Women are going to present, well, there's going to be different issues, and women are going to have different roles in households, different kinds of employment. You're not going to find the same thing in every area. So, but on the other hand, I think it's a very important facet of women's activities in all sorts of places, and that we've just, you know, we here really analyzed a lot of the contribution that women have been making. Well, in the last few years, I've been doing field work in Puerto Rico, and I think also one of the stereotypes we have, maybe not us, but that is in the literature, is that somehow women in areas that have less industrialization, or women in areas that are not in the center of the capitalist system, or whatever way you want to look at it. And Puerto Rico is kind of in the middle. Puerto Rico is partly, perhaps part of an advanced capitalist system, and it's partly very poor and rural, and some people might see it as third world. I don't know, to me, you know, we have to come back. But the thing is that I think it's important to look at women's activities in other areas and begin to build up a body of literature around that whole issue. So I thought I'd talk about Puerto Rico today. And this is based on fieldwork over the past since 1982, over, you know, just like 2 or 3 months at a time since then. And I want to examine the role of women in the development of a grassroots protest around health issues. And where I worked was in what a sort of semi-rural barrio, a small area, a small village in the southeast, on the southeast coast of Puerto Rico. And the issue which confronts this barrio concerns the choice between health and work, because they've been bringing in industry. So rural areas and can pay people very low. And the reason I first went there was because I was working in Cleveland, where an industry, a plant was closing down, and they were moving from Puerto Rico, so I came to the plant. So it's very clearly the work that the people in Greenpoint are losing is ending up in areas like Puerto Rico, or lower paying areas like Sri Lanka or whatever. So that's why I followed it, to see what was going on at the other end. But it is an area which is very rural, although they have respect it. And what I found was that a domestic issue, the diagnosis of an increase of family health problems, led to the formation of a neighborhood protest system, which in turn led to a confrontation between a multinational corporation, the workers in that industry, and neighborhood residents. So, and the women were very central in that. In fact, the activities emanated originally from the observations of the women in the barrier. So it's a relationship between the neighborhood and the community surrounding factors and what actually happened in the industry. Just to give you some background, I don't know how much give you, but the Puerto Rican economy has, of course, been very much influenced by American investment. And until the 50s, sugar and coffee were the main exports to American corporations. Then there was some a switch starting in the 50s. They brought in garments and textile factories hiring women. Later on, in the 70s, there was a huge increase in pharmaceutical corporations and the booming in the manufacturing industry. And that was part of the policy of the Puerto Rican Economic Development Administration and also the industry here. In the area where I work, 3 American corporations established plants around the city of Yabucoa. That was the city in the municipal area where I work. And 2 were very large industrial plants that were supposed to hire about 1,500 workers and were very between hiring 300 and 1,000. And the 3rd was a cigarette packing factory that hired about 100 men. All the plants hired only men for these new plants. And consistent with the policies of the Puerto Rican government and American corporations, sugarcane is really just declined in the whole house. Yabucoa has about 40,000 people. And in fact, it's not really a city. It's a group of barrios, and one of which I'm working. And there may be about, say, well, in Barrio I work with 1,500 people, and there's about 5 or 6 barriers all around the area. So the people live in homes surrounded by plots where they do gardening. It's not like they're living in a city area, although it's, you know, it's a municipality. The barrio that I worked in, Barrio Antonio, was created in 1957 by the sugar companies. And people were brought there to settle there by the sugar mill, because they wanted workers to live in that area. They were given land, and they built their own houses. And most of the people living there are the descendants of sugar. Which, of course, you know, sugar mills only operated for about 8 years, so they were basically unemployed the rest of the time. And still, when they work in the mills, it's like that.
8 years?
Yeah, 8 to 12 years. It's really very, very early. So that everybody, sugar mills, the sugar cane was very, very low paid. Okay, when they brought in the industry, that made a tremendous difference in the area. Men that were hired in the industry earned something like $7 an hour, which is half what they would have done here. could say 1918, but it was a tremendous amount more than they had earned in the sugar mill. So that when you look at the village now, the people that still work in sugar have the poorest houses, they have the mud floors, they have the lack of sanitation. The people that work in the industry, well, the men work usually, they have a new car in front of the grinder, they have their houses with corrugated iron decoration, really painted. You know, there's a tremendous difference in the however, most of the households, except for the people, in fact, the very I worked in at the time, only about up to 59 employees in the industry. Most of the households are supported by food stamps. I don't have any more research on that. Anyway, the barrio is very interesting, the way the social life works in the barrio. The stores are a very important area. That is where the men hang out. The stores, are, most of the stores are also bars. They keep taking back the stores, not like this. And there's maybe one or two chairs, but the men hang out. You see, you walk into the barrio, or the driving barrio, and you go past these groups of men. And they're definitely the stores of the social center. And in the evening, the men have been gathering in front of the store, and they sort of, that's where the policies of the village are set. There's no, the village is very separate. It doesn't have, like, a police, no police section. No fire engines. There aren't any fire hydrants. You know, it's that, not that it's in any way pre-industrial. It's part of, but they have very few facilities organized by the municipality. Most of it is places really run by people that live there, and the men hang out, and that's where they really discuss what's going on. The women socialize in their houses, they do not hang out in front of the store as well, and where most of the decisions are made. And the women don't even go much in shopping. They don't go to the center of the boiler or the bill to buy the food. And then when they want cheaper food, the men, if they have a car, the women don't drive, the men drive to the supermarket to buy food. So the women don't have the same kind of sociability